Funny question. Do you happen to know anyone in LA?
some people, yeah.
Because, well, just because obviously we haven't publicized it or anything yet, but I had a look on the analytics earlier and it's had a few listens, and one of those was from Los Angeles.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who would be listening to it like me in a parallel universe, because that's where I'm supposed to be like right now. Everyone, and welcome to Somewhere in Between, the podcast for AITs made by AITs, brought to you by the Royal College of GPs. I'm Anthony James, I'm an ST3 in North London, and I'm AIT Chair of the Royal College of GPs, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Mira and Hatim.
Hi.
Hello.
So today's episode of the podcast, again, we're going to be focusing on COVID-19, and we want to focus on kind of the top 10 questions that we've heard from trainees around the country, covering lots of different issues related to the coronavirus pandemic. Does that sound good to you guys?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. I guess diving straight in, one of the questions that has been asked a lot by trainees, but also lots of people around us, I guess, is how long is this pandemic going to go on for?
If only I had a crystal ball right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect GP question, because general practice is all about managing uncertainty, and I guess this specific question around how long the pandemic's going to continue for is something that nobody truly knows the answer to yet. We've seen lots of different predictions, and I guess the key modelling that the government's been following most recently has said that this should be going on for at least the next 6 months, but potentially even longer. And there might be periods over the next 18 months where we come out of kind of social distancing measures, and then based on testing and further outbreaks, might have to go back into them. So I guess it's not going to be a few weeks. We're definitely looking at a few months to potentially over even a year where we're going to have all of this ongoing, which I guess is something difficult that we're all going to have to deal with, but it's good just to, in my head, has been good to start thinking, actually, this isn't necessarily a short-term thing. This is something that we're all going to have to get used to. And the new ways of working that we're seeing are going to be continuing for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and I think another way that I've been looking at it is that often, whether we've been doing different hospital jobs or in GPs, that we're asked difficult questions a lot. And I think this just goes part and parcel with those. So having difficult conversations, talking about uncertainty and managing those, whether they are actually long-term chronic conditions or end-of-life care, which are things that are still coming up on a daily basis for us all, but also being honest about what we do know about the pandemic. You know, we're getting our information from similar sources to the general public as well. So having that open, honest discussion, I think, is really key.
There will also be some variation across the country, and that's also relevant to us as trainees, because someone training in London might be affected differently to someone training in the Northwest. And actually speaking to some of my colleagues in different areas, they are essentially still waiting for things to really impact them. And they're almost trying to look at what's happening in some of the more areas where things are quite impacted, to try and learn about what they should be doing and how they should be preparing. And I think we can do the same when it comes to considering how long this is going to last and what measures need to be ended at different times, and what that means for us as trainees.
Yeah, definitely. Because learning by example, you're right, Hatim. I've heard from people who are sort of working up in the north of England, in Scotland, and also in Cornwall. And it's all about being prepared and being ready. And I think that as much information as you can have from other colleagues that are working in your areas, what's working in terms of, saying, triage in general practice, or in particular corona hubs, which we'll come to talk about a bit later, there's a lot of good practice and a lot of evolving practice coming along, especially with technology and working from home and things like that. So in a time of crisis, we are seeing a lot of hopefully positive changes as well.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, the three of us work in an urban city kind of environment, but my mum, for example, works in a GP surgery in the pharmacy. They have a dispensary in the practice which she works in, and they work in a rural population, predominantly elderly people, and already they haven't had particularly lots of cases of coronavirus, but they've already started to set up kind of their local volunteering hub so that elderly people can stay at home. They've got a good delivery service for their medications. They've got a service where people in the villages are delivering food to people who should be staying at home. And it seems like a really nice supportive atmosphere. And I know that there are very few silver linings with all of this, but my mum was saying how it's been really lovely to bring an already close community even closer together.
Yeah, definitely. I think this sense of community, I grew up in a really small village in the north of England, and there was definitely a big sense of community. And I sort of maybe felt I lost that a little bit moving to London. But what was really heartwarming the other night at 8 o'clock, I really didn't think that there would be people hanging out of, you know, the windows of their flats or on their balconies in the middle of Greenwich clapping for the NHS. But it was so loud and heartwarming. People were banging pans and cheering and all sorts. So it does show that, you know, wherever you are, there is that community. It's just knowing where to go and how to find it.
Yeah,
it was actually one of the most special parts of last week was that appreciation, and actually joining in and clapping for everyone and the NHS as a service as a whole was wonderful.
Yeah, I feel awful because I had actually totally forgotten about it until 8 o'clock came, and then I suddenly heard this like cheering and clapping.
You thought there was a riot going on.
Yeah. But then we also joined in. It was really lovely and special, and I think a lot of people thought that the British public might not join in, but actually, so it was amazing that all across the country, everyone really did get on board with it. And I think for everyone, all of us that are working in healthcare, we really did appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's question one. How long will the pandemic go on for? And we haven't got a clear answer, but I guess we're coming down to somewhere between 6 months up to even maybe 18 months, a couple of years with all of this ongoing. But at least for the next 6 months, I'd imagine this is going to be having quite a big impact on the way we work.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair summing up.
Yeah. Question number two is, what is a coronavirus hub? And so this is obviously more relevant to people working in primary care. But guys, what is a coronavirus hub?
So at this stage, it seems like there's no definite answer for what is a coronavirus hub, because people are doing it very differently in each areas. And actually, majority of places in the UK haven't actually got one set up yet. So there's an interesting survey done by Trish Greenlaw and her team looking at primary care and where coronavirus hubs have been set up, and getting some feedback on how they're doing. And actually only 25% were able to share their experiences of what's going on. So that just shows how many areas that don't actually have one in place yet. And then quite a lot of uncertainty, quite a lot of frustration about how they're going. But in some areas, things are going well. So it's really about learning where things are happening quite well and taking that forward. There's also a bit of discussion about how do we deliver hubs. So really it's a centre in the community that's going to be responsible for triaging or making decisions for patients with coronavirus. Is that going to be virtually? Is that going to be in person? And what's going to be the main function of that hub? And in terms of patient contact, are they going to still see their own GP? Are they still going to call 111? Or are they going to directly go to a coronavirus hub? That's also something that's being decided.
And I think a question also is who staffs these hubs as well. So would it be locum GPs, would it be other sort of healthcare professionals from the community, or redeployed members of staff from other clinical areas as well? So I think there's a lots of discussion, and there doesn't seem to be current standardization, but obviously, as you can appreciate, it's probably a very evolving concept as things progress.
Yeah, and I think there's probably some positives in letting them develop organically and then learning from what's working. And I guess different models might work differently in different areas around the country. But from some of the stuff that I've seen, people have been either thinking about doing things at a PCN level. So you might have a few practices working together, and one of those might be kind of a hot hub for people who need to be seen face to face. And that could be cross-covered by people working across all of the different sites. And those who are able to work face to face could do a period of time in one of those practices serving as the hot hub for that PCN. Equally, though, there are some models that have been suggested where it's more based around a hospital site. So lots of practices all coming together and then having a few hubs which are set up to see the face-to-face patients that have been triaged by the GPs working in collaboration with the hospital. So then you might also have a team, including some hospital consultants. So if you're concerned someone might need to be admitted, then you can have really quick direct access to that team to say this person can can or cannot come into hospital or come up with a plan with other healthcare professionals. And then also, I guess, a CCG based model. So the whole of the CCG might set up a number of hubs for their locality, again, in working with the other partners that work in that health, in their own healthcare system.
Yeah.
There's different ways of doing it.
And obviously these things will be varying, as you both said, depending on where you are and what the need is and what's going on with supply and demand of PPE and various other things that are going on in your locality. So I guess it would be helpful for us to know as well what's happening where you are, to let us know, do you have a hub? Have you been working there, or have you been asked about it or told any information? It would be really useful to know what's going on around the country so that we can share that with everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also a lot of anxiety for doctors that obviously will be working in these hubs due to things like PPE, which we'll be hopefully coming on to later in the podcast, but also things like death in service benefit. This is something that we have to bear in mind, especially if the people that are going to be working at these hubs are locum doctors. What kind of protection do they get? Will they be put on sort of longer term contracts? What will it mean for family members, etc.?
Yeah. So I guess hubs, again, something which is working in development, but essentially will be a place where patients who need to be assessed face-to-face can go. And that might be patients, initially it might be patients who are thought to be with coronavirus risks, but eventually I reckon this will move to, for a period of time, all patients who need to be seen face-to-face, because we'll start to think that any face-to-face contact has the potential risk associated with it of transmitting coronavirus. I guess the other thing, which is in the same ballpark as coronavirus hubs, is also the new Nightingale hospitals, which are starting up. And I know that there's been a call for certain GPs, or particularly I've seen letters going out to locums and certain GPs working in specific areas to see if they'd like to go and work in the new Nightingale hospitals. Again, that's going to be an area of interest. Also, just from, we got a letter for less than full-time trainees that went out last week, which said, if you were interested in increasing your hours, then one of the places that you might end up working could be one of the Nightingale hospitals. So that's also going to be interesting to see how those hospitals are set up and how care is delivered within those. So
yeah.
Again, if you do start working in one of those, then let us know. It'll be really interesting to hear the stories from those buildings as well.
Absolutely, which I think quite nicely brings us round to the next topic we wanted to talk about, which was PPE, I guess, and specifically about, there's obviously been a lot of debate, it's been in the media, it's been in the news quite a lot this week about PPE or lack thereof that's been available to healthcare professionals, and when should it be used, and perhaps why guidance is varying from the World Health Organization's current stance on it all. But I suppose the question really is, how can GPs use PPE safely, or what should they be doing?
Yeah, I mean, what I'll do is, first I'll just share a bit of my experience about how things have been in accident and emergency. So I've been on A&E since February. And when things started, there wasn't very much sort of in place in terms of PPE. And we were initially advised to start using surgical masks, gloves and aprons, but things have really evolved in the last couple of weeks, and now we will have equipment with the proper FFP3 masks, we have aprons, we have proper gowns, and we have visors or goggles. And the other thing that's come in is proper areas to put on your gear and also take off your gear, and lots of guidance about what you should do with your clothes when you're going home after work, and what you should do once you get into the house, washing your clothes, making sure you have a shower to try and make sure that you're clean as much as possible to prevent any spread of the virus. So this is an area where there's a lot of progression on, there's a lot of campaigning on in terms of getting this right. The BMA are doing a lot of work and trying to make sure that things improve, because we have to make sure that we're protected when we're caring for patients with coronavirus, to also protect our patients, to prevent further spread to the other patients, but also to protect ourselves and our family. It's something that will need to come into play when we consider what's going to happen in GP as well. So it'll be interesting actually to hear from you, Anthony, and see what you've had in your practice when it comes to PPE.
Yeah, so we've always had a fairly good supply of PPE in the form of like gloves, aprons and the surgical face masks. To be honest, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen so few patients face to face that we haven't gone through that supply at all. But I do know that in lots of other areas of the country, even getting hold of those basic bits of PPE has been a real challenge. So I think we've been in quite a fortunate position, but I guess this is also one of the the proposed benefits of having more centralized hubs is that also things like supplies of PPE could all be centralized in one place and allow the GPs who will be seeing patients face to face to always have reliable access to those vital bits of kit. Because as you say, Hatim, we want to be able to protect our patients, protect ourselves, and protect all of our loved ones, as well as being able to do our job. So I think in terms of using it safely, so we haven't necessarily got the best practice, like doffing and donning procedures in place, and which is something that we definitely will need to start looking at over the next few weeks. But you know, there's a lot of information that has come out in the last couple of weeks, especially around how to do that effectively. Also thinking about how to reduce your risk of taking COVID-19 home with you. So, you know, like taking your clothes off when you get in, having a shower, those kind of things, if you've been working in particularly high risk areas. So we can share some links to the up-to-date guidance. I know there's been guidance from NHS England, as well as Public Health England, and also the college has bits and pieces of information around it as well. Because, you know, for most GPs working in primary care, thinking properly about wearing personal protective equipment is not something that we do every day. So even, you know, to me, the idea of, you couldn't even remember the last time I would use the word doffing and donning. So I think it is important to get it right and to make sure that we can all have access to the kit as well as the right information on how to use it effectively.
Yeah, I can definitely say from working on the ward a couple of weeks ago now, having watched the doffing and donning videos, I was really, really grateful to know there's a very specific order in which ways you take off the mask or the visor or the gown. And if you haven't watched those videos, you're probably a little bit on the back foot. So we will definitely link those from the official guidance so that people, AITs working in secondary care and primary care, know what they should be doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a particular skill to wearing those masks all day as well. They get quite irritant after a while. So I finally gone clean shaven, also to sort of protect myself from a PPE point of view as well. And hopefully that will help.
Yeah, and also makes you look like 10 years younger, Hatton.
Yes, you can see what we can see right now.
So that's PPE. And then question four was one around remote assessment skills. So how can I improve my skills in remote assessments? And again, over the last few weeks working in primary care, there's been a massive change to the way that we do things. So most practices are now doing total telephone triaging. We've also started using video consultations. And I know that that's true for a huge number of GP practices around the country who are using things like Accurix or have other video consulting platforms that they've got up and running over the last couple of weeks to help facilitate being able to deliver patient care safely and effectively. So I know that you guys are both working in hospitals. Has there been any movement on, if you know, kind of like routine clinic follow-ups or things that need to be done remotely in the hospital setting as well?
Yeah, so I came originally from a very clinic-based elderly care job, and effectively what we did was to contact a lot of the patients to see if we could do things over the phone. Admittedly, this was right at the beginning of when all of this was escalating, so we still had a few patients that we were seeing face-to-face. But what I sort of understand now is that our clinics are becoming pretty much almost 100% virtual. So either done via phone, and they are looking into other ways of doing teleconsults and things for the sort of, they're not urgent consultations, but that patients need advice on, you know, important medications and other things. Because I think although coronavirus is taking over the little world at the moment, medicine still goes on. People are still ill from other conditions and, you know, lots of other questions that are pressing and really matter to them and their families, which we sort of still need to be there to support them with. So it's about managing the best of both scenarios, really.
Yeah, that's one of the difficulties with this pandemic is managing the patients that are obviously suffering from the virus itself, but also making sure that you're managing your patients overall with other sort of chronic problems or chronic conditions. And that occurs both in primary and secondary care. And it takes a lot more skill to be able to do that remotely rather than do that with a patient in front of you. This is something that I've been championing for quite a long time, is the use of digital and virtual consultations. And it's quite nice to see it come into play. But obviously, we haven't had a lot of training on it. And that is something that's missing from our programs. And I think it's something that we need to take forward when this does settle down to our VTSs, to have more training and support to enable us to deliver both telephone and video consultations, which will be a big part of our future in NHS.
Yeah, and I think it would be good to know that the RCGP does actually have some really good resources available on their COVID hub. So there are some sort of telephone consultation top tips. There's some advice on how to do video consulting, how the setup should be. And I think that would be really useful if you've not checked that out yet, as our way of working will be changing as time goes on, to check out the other resources that are available on the hub, which I'm sure Anthony will tell us a little bit more about.
There's also, very quickly before Anthony goes into that, there's also some really good videos on YouTube. So there's EGP Learning, who has some videos on remote consulting and on video consulting. So that's run by Dr. Hussein Gandhi. And there's also Dr. Aman Arora's videos, and he has a few on delivering video consultations as well. So just look out for those on YouTube, and we'll try and post a link to a couple if we can.
Yeah, I think a few of those links are actually also included in the college's COVID resource hub. So this was a hub that was launched now a couple of weeks ago and is being updated every couple of days with new guidance and information for GPs to help equip them to handle COVID-19 cases. There's everything on there from kind of up-to-date guidance being released from the government about COVID-19 to more specific consulting and clinical skills. So one, for example, is a top 10 tips for COVID-19 telephone consultations, which was put together by Roger Naber, like one of the gods of consultation skills, and Simon Stockley, who's one of the RCGP's clinical champions. And this is a really nice starting point, I think, for just looking at the way that you deliver telephone consultations specifically around patients who are coming to you with symptoms of coronavirus. So it has everything from checking for specific red flags or signs of deterioration, deciding if telephone management is appropriate or if they might need a face-to-face consultation, giving clear information about staying at home and self-isolation, and then obviously all important safety netting, and then when you should trigger a face-to-face consultation as well. So it's a really good starting point, but there's loads of resources that are being put onto the resource hub. We'll link to it in the description for this week's podcast, and you can have a look at the information that's being populated there.
And one other resource that I just wanted to point out to everybody as well is, I think we all appreciate that a lot of us will have patients who don't speak English, or indeed relatives that don't speak English, that we want to be speaking to them about things to do with coronavirus. So there has been translated NHS guidance that's been done by Doctors of the World, and they've translated all the NHS guidance into 34 different languages. So especially if you're working in an area where there is a high population of people who are non-English speakers, please have a look at that guidance. You may find it really, really helpful when trying to communicate with people on the phone.
Yeah, it's also really interesting to think about how you would deliver your clinical examination over the phone. So I saw some interesting resources saying things like asking the patient to describe how their breathing is, using tools that the patient might have in the house. So do they have a thermometer? Can you get a temperature from them? Do they have a pulse oximeter? Can you get their saturations from them? Especially in this current climate, people are having more of these resources within their own properties, within their own homes. So it's interesting to try and think about how you can use those to help you make the right clinical decision for that person.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these resources talk about exactly that, like how to make a judgment on whether somebody's breathlessness, depending on how it's impacting on their ADLs. Also, there's obviously a lot of discussion of using things like the Roth score at the minute, which is where you get your patient to take a deep breath in and see how many numbers they can count up to. So between 1 to 30, a score of greater than 8 is basically meant to be normal saturations, and then less than 8, I can't remember the exact percentages, but can give you some of the very few studies on this score that exist have said that it can give you some information about whether someone's SATs might be below 95%. So not necessarily the world's best validated tool, but in this climate where we're practicing in a completely new way, is also something to think about. What tools can I use to help assess somebody over the phone? So all of these kind of resources are linked to in the resource hub. Cool. So that's kind of resources on clinical skills and remote assessments. Then coming, the next few questions relate back to some specifics about training. So question number 5, when will MRCGP exams start again?
So yeah, if we all knew that answer, we would definitely be telling you right now. As of now, the information I guess, pretty much stays the same as the RCGP statement and the email that was sent out last week. So the fact that the exams have now been postponed for the foreseeable future, and the likelihood is that they will probably be restarting in September, as far as we know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, at least, yeah, it will definitely be the autumn when things get restarted, and that will all depend on what the situation looks like at that point. So obviously, if strict social distancing measures were still in place come the autumn, then exams might have to be delayed further. But hopefully, as soon as some of those measures are relaxed, then we can start doing some form of examinations again. There's been a lot of questions from trainees all over the country about this, and I can really appreciate how much of a worry and concern it is. I was meant to sit my CSA in a couple of weeks' time, and obviously now I feel, you know, equally uncertain about whether I'm going to have an extension to my training, what my future is going to look like over the next year. And we do, as a college, really appreciate all of you that are feeling a similar way at the minute and are doing everything we can to find an answer to these really important questions.
Yeah, I think that obviously the same thing can be said for people who are worried about CCT and delays that are associated with that, about extension of training, but also what does that mean in terms of ARCP for ST1s right all the way up to ST3s as well. And I suppose it's in an evolving landscape and a shift. We're all having to accommodate and adapt to the new ways of working at the moment, and I guess training is unfortunately no different to that. So but people are having conversations, there are being meetings and things are being discussed. So it's not just sort of being left to the wayside. And hopefully we will all be sort of in the know as this situation develops.
Yeah, there will be a lot of your colleagues that were due to sit AKT or due to sit CSA. So just check in on them, make sure they're okay. And really just support each other through this. That's all we can do at this stage.
Yeah. And the college has even, you know, looked at other ways that the exams could be delivered. So there's definitely been thoughts about whether something like the AKT could be delivered remotely. I think from what I've heard, doing that would add a lot of extra expense, which would all filter down to candidates. So I don't necessarily think that anyone wants to be paying any more for their exams. So while things are still so unclear, and hopefully, you know, come the autumn, we will be able to start physical exams again, it hopefully will be able to kind of deal with the backlog and prioritize people who need to get their AKT done as soon as possible at that point. So, but people definitely are having the right conversations. The thing that I found most reassuring is how high priority all of the senior decision makers across all of the organizations responsible for training, whether that's the college, Health Education England, or the GMC, they're all taking this seriously. All of the right people are meeting regularly to discuss this and trying to find the solution which feels most appropriate and palatable to trainees.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of brings us on to things like portfolio and workplace assessments, and in terms of looking at what you need for your portfolio. And I think ultimately the general feeling is that as long as you have been engaged with your portfolio up until this point where things have gone into sort of a bit of a meltdown, for a better term, it's that you shouldn't be encountering other issues. It might be really difficult to get, you know, COTS whilst you're in GP, if you're not seeing people anymore, but making sure that you're discussing your cases with your supervisor as and when you can, and also reflecting on, you know, situations here and there as you go. And I suppose the general diktat is that for ST1s and ST2s, as long as you've been following that and have been engaging with your portfolio from the start of the this year of training, then we should be okay.
Yeah. I think so long as you've been progressing satisfactorily and you had your first kind of sign off and that was all fine, then over the next, before your next ARCP, so long as you've continued to reflect in your portfolio and there have been no other concerns raised, then you should be able to get through that despite not being able to fill in all of the other workplace-based assessments. That's for ST1s and ST2s. And then for ST3s, so in order to kind of get past your workplace-based assessment element of your assessments, at the minute people are saying that you probably would have to have completed 50% of everything in total. That doesn't mean in any one area, so it doesn't mean you have to have done 50% of your COTS or 50% of your observed procedures. It just means in general you have to have done about 50% of everything. And again, so long as you've been progressing satisfactorily, your trainer's willing to sign you off as competent for everything, then you should also pass that element, even if you've not been able to complete all of the other elements of the assessments. For this year, that will also be true for things like basic life support and safeguarding, where you'd normally have to do a few different elements to pass that. But this year, they're saying that you would only need to have done an online course and uploaded and reflected on that in your portfolio to have met the requirements for each of those.
That's a real reassurance overall. I think one of the things that I've been anxious about is actually for those in hospital jobs where things are very busy, things are changing all the time, we'll be able to get our workplace-based assessments done because everyone will be really busy at a senior level and actually sending them forms is really not a priority right now. So it is reassuring to know there'll be some leeway on that. And I'm sure we'll have more guidance as it comes through over the next months.
I think that's, you know, everyone's trying to be pragmatic in this situation, and the pressure of this situation is not just being felt by trainees, but by all healthcare professionals and all of our trainers and supervisors. So equally, you know, I think you should still have a relationship with those people and check in, and they should be there to support you. But, you know, definitely filling out workplace-based assessment forms is not the top of anyone's priority list at the minute. If you can get them done, great, but it won't be an essential part.
And lots of people may be finding that their working roles are going to be changing over the coming weeks as well. So whether you're going to be moving from your current clinical area or helping out at the new hubs or Nightingale Centre. So all of that is good experience, which, you know, when you have the time to reflect upon would be perfectly fine, but absolutely it's not going to be mandated, I don't think.
Yeah. And equally, I think it's also important to say at this point that while some requirements might be relaxed around things like workplace-based assessments, something that shouldn't be relaxed is the fact that all trainees should be able to have access to like safe supervision at all times. So if you are finding that you're working in a new team or a new area, I'm going to keep saying this over and over again, but that should still mean that you get adequate supervision. So if you feel like you're not getting that, it's important to raise that and let somebody know so that can be kind of escalated appropriately as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with that. And I suppose that our next question was sort of, we've been talking about people who are working in clinical areas and maybe changing roles, but something people did want to know is, can trainees work from home? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, so again, I think this is something which will be very area specific, but there's no specific rule that would prevent a trainee from working from home. So in my current practice at the minute, we're just getting set up to be able to do triaging from home. There's a few hurdles to jump to be able to do that. So we're waiting for the delivery of some laptops at the minute, which hopefully should be coming next week. Lots of other people are waiting for access via VPNs and other ways of accessing your patient record at home as well. So you definitely should be able to work from home as a trainee if your practice is set up to be able to do that. But again, if you are working from home, that doesn't mean that you should be working in an unsupervised way. You should still be able to access supervision remotely at all times.
Yeah, and again, this would be interesting to hear from the rest of you across the country about working from home. If has that been facilitated for you by certain surgeries, or what the sort of situation is out there?
Yeah,
in terms of sort of software, Anthony, and obviously your practice is in the process of going through this, what have they needed to do to ensure they have everything on your laptop so you can work at home?
Well, for us, the CCG had ordered like something like 70 laptops to be distributed amongst practices. So every practice should have a supply of these laptops, which would come kind of pre-configured for you to be able to do everything at home, and would obviously have the right software on board to be able to do it. Otherwise, for a lot of people who are accessing patient records via like a VPN token, that mean I'm not sure, like every laptop will be, you'll need a certain requirements for your laptop. So I think some people have issues accessing them on Macs. Also for VPNs, the system, I've seen lots of people posting on WhatsApp and stuff about how the system keeps crashing. It can be quite difficult to access. Mm-hmm. You know, at the minute, loads of practices will all be going through this process. So everyone will be wanting to work from home as much as possible. Lots of people who aren't able to work face-to-face because of underlying medical reasons will also need to be all getting on the network at the same time. So there's bound to be a lot of teething problems with this. But I think moving forward, again, if we look for one of the very few silver linings that might exist from this crisis, being able to work more flexibly, being able to do more remotely will definitely be beneficial to all GPs once the COVID-19 pandemic has passed as well.
Yeah, as we all know, IT can be pretty challenging in the NHS as it is. I mean, I've been waiting 15, 20 minutes sometimes to get onto my computer, let alone EMIS. So it's good to see there's some progress in this area, and hopefully we're just going to have a little bit of patience for it to come through.
Yeah, I think the shape of how we deliver primary care and other things will probably have a dramatic shift after we get over this pandemic. And it will be really interesting to see the good work that comes out of this, not just from the UK, but obviously all over the world as well, that who have all had to adapt based on what's been happening to them and the population there.
Yeah, I also think just like an interesting thing, and it, you know, we've seen this in lots in primary and secondary care settings where the demand on the system has actually dropped quite a lot in lots of different areas. So if we kind of park everything that's happening with COVID-19, other demand seems to have dropped off. More patients are staying away. They're not going to A&E. They're not coming to the GP. And so some of that will be people delaying things which definitely need to be being seen, which is a negative. But I think if it also makes all of us reflect on how we can care for ourselves a bit better, how we can access information sort of online about self-limiting conditions, or you know, questions about certain specifics about medications or things which can be accessed through other means, then I think that will also be like a long-term benefit that we see from this. If people are able to kind of be more independent, self-care, and take more ownership over their conditions, I think those would all be really positive as well for doctors as well as for patients.
Yeah, definitely. I think people being more resourceful for their own sort of healthcare is really important, but they're also looking at different public health strategies as well. Saw quite an interesting letter to the Times that various doctors have written from a public health perspective in terms of looking at other things, other factors that put a lot of strain on our general healthcare system. So for instance, trying to encourage everyone to drive lower than the speed limit to reduce the impact of traumas and accidents and various other things that may happen, which obviously requires a whole lot of resource, a whole lot of care within, say, trauma centres and other things. And if people drove more sensibly or indeed decided not to drive and stay at home, then that would be a huge chunk of resources that could be allocated to the current crisis. So there are some really interesting incentives out there and innovations out there in terms of just a public health agenda as well, which I think is really interesting to learn about.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter over the weekend an orthopaedic reg had posted that this was the first weekend they've ever worked where there were, one of the days there was nobody on the trauma list, just because people are obviously staying at home and not getting involved in their like sporting or other accidents where been on a night out and broken their ankle or whatever. So, you know, I think it's just really interesting to see how people are really changing their behaviour. And I guess that's something that we should all be thanking people for, is staying at home, staying safe and allowing the NHS to help deal with the pandemic as much as it can.
Definitely. Having said that, there are also slightly whimsical things that are making the newspaper. I don't know if both of you saw an article about an astrophysicist who's from Australia, and he was trying to find it. Well, he's devising and inventing a device that prevented people from touching their face as much, and so that the alarm would bleep. He was trying to make sort of like a necklace type device. But effectively what happened is that he was working with really, really strong magnets, and to cut a long story short, ended up with three magnets up his nostrils, and ended up having to go to A&E to get those removed. I think his doctor, his wife, who is a doctor, wasn't the best impressed. But, you know, some interesting things happening around the world.
Yeah, well, I was also thinking, cause, like, when people are at home, they obviously get more into, like, doing their gardening or their DIY or whatever. So I'm just waiting to have, like, a personal injury, because I'm definitely not handy with a toolkit. And we have quite a few things that we've been delaying doing.
No, definitely look after yourself there, Anthony. And I guess in the interest of this podcast not becoming an absolute saga, question number 9 was talking about people who have had to take time off for self-isolation due to COVID. Does that mean an extension in training, or what is the stance on people who have had to do this?
Yeah, so I think just a quick one on this is that from the guidance that's been released so far, if you did have to take a prolonged period of time off due to COVID-19, then it shouldn't impact on your ability to progress. That that shouldn't be something that anyone has to be too concerned about. Everyone appreciates that you might have to take time off, either for yourself or if you have sort of childcare requirement. That will be understood.
Good to
that
know.
Solves that. Yeah, clearly. I mean, a lot of our colleagues are unwell at the moment and are self-isolating, and it's important to remove that anxiety. for them. And actually coming on to that, one of the things that's really important for us in this class is actually tips for dealing with your own stress, maintaining your well-being during this pandemic, because obviously a lot of us are isolated and not seeing colleagues as much as usual. So how do we support ourselves? And at the same time, we're also having anxieties about coming into contact with patients with the virus and potentially getting the virus ourselves. What impact will that have on our own health and, like I said, our friends and family? So this is a really important area. And first thing I would say is a lot of work is being done by organisations. So at my trust, they've now brought in free staff parking. They've brought in free meals for staff. And these little things go a long way to actually helping you feel better at work. So that's something that we've been trying to champion for a long time. And it's good to see some of those changes happen. And hopefully that has a bit of a legacy when this all settles down.
Yeah, and I think to the trainees who maybe have taken time out of training, who are on maternity leave, or who may be in those high-risk groups that need to be socially isolated or distancing themselves, I think I've seen lots of people sort of expressing feelings of guilt because they can't be there and work on the front line. But it's really important to know that your skills are needed and required, and people would much rather you be safe and looking after yourself and your families and be able to return to work when it's a better time to do so, because, you know, we all need to help each other out in this, and no doubt everybody's time to be there and represent will be coming in the future anyway.
Yeah, I think all of us are going to be dealing, as Hatim says, with some really challenging emotions over the coming months, and taking care of ourselves is a real priority. So like for me, obviously all of us have been allowed to get out of the house once a day to do some exercise. We've like lucky to have a bit of extra space in the house, so we've set up like a little bit of a mini home gym so that we can keep doing some of the classes and things that me and my husband both enjoy. Also things like this, so digital tools for keeping in touch with one another. It's always good to see other people's faces as well. I know loads of people have joined up to things like House Party, which is one of the apps, which has been like really good. Today was meant to be today is my grand's 100th birthday, which is
happy birthday.
we're meant to have a party for her yesterday, which obviously social distancing can't do, but we're gonna have a little house party later on just so that we can all say hello and happy birthday. We all sent her a little video message so that she could wake up to this morning, and she obviously got her card from the Queen and the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, I think they get one.
Wow.
Which she was thrilled by. So even if we can't have a party, and obviously I'm sure that's really disappointing, if you get to 100, you think you'd be entitled to a party, but we can still do things to keep in touch and make sure that she has as nice and as safe a day as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it goes without saying, it's just looking out for each other and making sure the colleagues who seem to be coping really well, you're just checking in with them as well. I think the technology that we have is actually pretty astonishing. Like Anthony said, using Zoom and House Party means that you're connecting with people that you probably haven't messaged or talked to in quite a long time, as well as the people you want to speak to daily, whether that's your parents or family or kids or friends. And I know for a lot of AITs, their general teaching may have been cancelled or is on hold for the indefinite future, but there's no reason why you and your small groups or other trainees can't meet at a scheduled time in the weekday or the weekend. And just to check in on each other and see how things are going. No doubt this time is just going to be really tough on us all with all the things we're going to have to see, do and deal with. So talking about that's important. But the other thing I will also say is, having been at home for a couple of days on annual leave, is that you get inundated with the amount of information that has been there. So one thing that I found really, really helpful is actually to not go on the news channels, to not check my phone and Twitter and things for, you know, from 4 o'clock onwards till the next morning, just so that I can focus on other things. Because otherwise you definitely do feel like it's taking over your entire life. And absolutely, there will be some people who want to be kept up to date all the time, but everybody's different. And if you want to shut away from it, then you totally should, just for a period of time.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I've definitely found myself feeling a bit overwhelmed by just the sheer level of volume of information and noise coming through over the last couple of weeks. And so I think for all of us, just taking a bit of time to try and switch off is really important. And there's also just, you know, there's a few really good apps to help with some of that if you are struggling. So there are things like Headspace have given free subscriptions to NHS staff. There's another one called UpMind, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And then there's a few other like similar ones which are offering free services to healthcare workers at the minute. So I'm using Headspace at the minute, and it's just a nice additional thing to do at the end of a day or early in the morning, just to help just break away from everything for at least a few minutes.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I've had a few days off from ED, and we've been doing things like yoga. We decided to do a bit of baking and actually made some banana bread, which was great. So I think it's just fun to just actually get away from things a little bit and do things that are a little bit different, and just take yourself away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, look after yourselves. And effectively, we also wanted just to say thank you to everybody for all their hard work. We know times are really tough. Doesn't look like that they're going to get any easier anytime soon. And as lots of people probably have said already, that we are preparing, we're in a marathon at the minute, probably at the early stages of it as well. So thank you to everyone who is involved in everything that's going on at the moment.
Yeah. And obviously, we've already heard some tragic news about a few doctors that have passed away during the COVID-19 outbreak here in the UK. So we heard about Dr. Habib Zaidi, who is a GP in Essex, who passed away a few days ago. Mr. El Hawari, who was a ENT surgeon at in a hospital in Derby, who passed away on Saturday. And then another doctor, Dr. Adil El Tayar, who also passed away at Middlesex University Hospital. So we just want to send a shout out to all of their families, just to say where everyone in the healthcare service is thinking of you, and thanks for everything that your loved ones did to help support during the current crisis. And if we look at kind of Italy, where many more doctors have passed away, we know that that's probably going to be the case here. So I think it's just important for us all to say thank you for everything that you're doing. Take care of yourself, and just try and stay as safe as possible.
Dr. Habib Zaidi was a GP and had been a GP for 49 years. So it's served three generations of families in his locality of Southend. So it's important to recognise the incredible work that he did in his role. And actually, something that's quite nice when I was reading a tribute to him is that his name means beloved, and beloved he truly was. So may he rest in peace, and all our condolences to all his family.
Yeah, I think this is a time for fighting the good fight, as people are saying, but also reflecting on the hardships that lots of people are going through, but also looking into your communities and into the world where there are lots of good things and lots of community spirited things that are happening, even in hospital departments where restaurants are providing free food for staff. People are, you know, sort of going out and beyond their way to try and help key workers in whatever sector they may be in. One nice thing I did see was, so every person in the general surgical department at the William Harvey Hospital lately have been trying to write an antiviral verse every few days, and they write it sort of on their surgical whiteboard. And it was shared on Facebook that one of the consultant surgeons, Miss Cook, she'd written something. So I thought we could maybe end on just the few words that she had written. So she said, "Corona used to be a beer. They garnished it with limes, but now it's filled the world with fear. These days are scary times. Cease from travel, cease from flying, shops stripped bare by panic buying. No shaking hands, no social hugs. They've even closed the clubs and pubs. Keep your distance, stay away. Now's not the time for simple play. Stay indoors, self-isolate, more stringent measures while they await. But never fear, for we are here, your frontline team, a healthcare dream. With PPE, gown, gloves, face shields, onward we venture to the battlefields. Come on, you virus, bring it on. Do your worst, we'll take you on. For we have spirit, compassion and love. We shall destroy you and rise above. Months, years from now, you'll be no more, a mere memory of what passed through our shore. Carry on, we will, the human race, supporting each other, our saving grace."
That's really lovely. And I can't think of a better way to close off this week's episode of Somewhere in Between. As always, if you do want to share your story or get involved, then you can always get in touch with us on the podcast email address, which is ait.chair@rcgp.org.uk. We're also all on Twitter, so you can find me at Dr. Anthony James.
You can find me at Dr. Meera Kumar.
And I'm at Dr_Hats.
Thanks everyone for joining us, and until next time, take care, stay safe, and we'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Just just a quick shout out to our listener in LA. Bryn, producer Bryn has kindly told us that you've been one of our only international listeners. So if you can get in touch and let us know why you're listening to us and what else we can do for you, then that would be great.
It's not about why you're listening to us. Why would you not be listening to us?